From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. One Mo' Time, a tribute to black vaudeville of the 1920s, just opened on Broadway. It's a revival of the original 1979 production. On today's Fresh Air, an interview and performance by the creator and star of the show, Vernell Bonnaries. The grueling long-distance sled dog race, the Iditarod, is currently underway, spanning over 1,100 miles from Anchorage to Nome, Alaska. Writer Gary Paulson will remember his experience in the race. Also, movie critic John Powers reviews We Were Soldiers, and TV critic David Bianculli reviews Sunday night's CBS special 9/11 with images from inside the burning World Trade Center. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Afghan government is sending more troops and tanks to eastern Afghanistan to back up a U.S.-led force that's battling al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters entrenched in the mountains. U.S. commanders on the scene say they believe they've killed more than 500 enemy fighters. Air Force General John Rosa told reporters that there are believed to be around 200 enemy fighters left. An Afghan official in the town of Gardez said the central government is sending 1,000 fresh Afghan soldiers to reinforce the 2,000 or so coalition fighters already on the battlefield. President Bush was in Florida today to attend a fundraiser and to promote his call for greater corporate responsibility. He also spoke about the war before a group that included some relatives of soldiers killed in Afghanistan. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president was speaking at a plant owned by an electronics company. He was there to talk about the economy and about business ethics, but as he does during most speeches, he also spoke of his resolve to do everything possible to defeat terrorists. At one point in the speech, he singled out family members of two U.S. soldiers who died in fighting. The relatives were in the front row of the audience. It was an emotional moment for the president.
I know your heart aches, and we ache for you. But your son and your brother died for a noble and just cause.
Fighting in Afghanistan has intensified in the past week as U.S. forces have begun their largest ground offensive of the war. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
President Bush promised to sign an economic stimulus plan passed today by the Senate. The measure, which won House approval yesterday, would extend unemployment benefits and give tax breaks to businesses. Groups representing the nation's hospitals are suing the Department of Health and Human Services over a rule limiting funding for the Medicaid program. NPR's Julie Rovner has more.
The National Association of Public Hospitals and 10 other groups filed suit in U.S. District Court in Arkansas. They charge that the Bush administration violated the federal rulemaking process in curtailing the use of a Medicaid payment mechanism. States and the federal government share funding for Medicaid. The Bush administration, like the Clinton administration before it, said states were abusing the financing technique to draw federal Medicaid funds for non-health purposes. But the hospital groups say the change, which could reduce federal Medicaid funding by $9 billion over the next 5 years, comes at a time states are having increasing difficulty paying their share of Medicaid costs. Bush administration officials say they're sympathetic to the state's financial woes, but they're standing by the rules. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 47 points to close at 10,572 in heavy trading. The Dow was up 203 points for the week. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 48 points today. This is NPR News. The State Department called on Israel today to stop attacks that lead to the deaths of innocent Palestinian civilians. Spokesman Richard Boucher said the United States strongly opposes the Israeli policy of targeted killing. He said that Israelis should think through the consequences of things like going into heavily populated areas with heavy military force. The statements came just a day after President Bush announced that he'd send his mediator, Anthony Zinni, back to the region in an effort to restart the peace process. Senator Fred Thompson of Tennessee has announced he will not seek re-election in November. Thompson's the fourth Republican in the closely divided Senate who's decided to retire rather than seek another term. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
In a written statement, Thompson said, quote, "I simply do not have the heart for another six-year term," adding he had other priorities to attend to. The 59-year-old former Watergate committee lawyer and screen actor considered retirement last year, but changed his mind after September 11th, saying, "Now is clearly not the time to leave." But colleagues say that changed after Thompson's 38-year-old daughter died in January following a heart attack. Possible contenders for his seat include former Tennessee Governor Lamar Alexander, a Republican, and House Democrats John Tanner and Harold Ford. Former Vice President Al Gore said he would not be a candidate. Republican Senators Strom Thurmond of South Carolina, Jesse Helms of North Carolina, and Phil Gramm of Texas will also not seek re-election to a Senate where Democrats have a one-vote majority. David Wilna, NPR News, The Capitol.
Kmart says it wants to close 280 stores, eliminating 22,000 jobs around the country. The discount chain asked a federal judge to approve the plan as part of a restructuring. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Vernell Bonnerice, opened on Broadway this week in a revival of One Mo' Time, which he also created and directed. It's a review that pays tribute to Black vaudeville of the 1920s. It's set in 1927 at the Lyric Theater in New Orleans. Bonnerice first staged One Mo' Time in 1979 in Manhattan. It ran for 3.5 years and toured the country. It was followed by the sequel, Further Mo'. Bonnerice also appeared in the films Down by Law and Pennies from Heaven. We were proud to feature him in two of the programs in our series on American popular song. I spoke with Vernell Bonnerice in 2000 when he was starring in the Prince Music Theater production of the Harold Arlen musical St. Louis Woman. Before we hear that interview, let's hear an excerpt of his 1992 Fresh Air appearance in which he performed excerpts of Jelly Roll, his tribute to Jelly Roll Morton, the composer, pianist, and singer who was one of the key figures in early jazz. Jelly Roll won an Obie Award and an Outer Critics Circle Award. We'll hear Morton Gunnar Larson at the piano.
Anytime you hear anybody playing jazz, what they playing is Jelly Roll. Now, I never got the credit for it, or the cash for that matter, but believe me, it's Jelly Roll. In foreign lands across the sea, they knight a man for bravery. Make him a duke or a count, you see, must be a member of the royalty. Mr. Jelly played a jazzy thing in the temple by the queen and king. All at once he struck upon a harmonic chord. The king said, make Mr. Jelly a lord. He's Mr. Jelly Lord, simply royal at the old keyboard. You should see him strolling down the street. The man's an angel with great big feet. With his melodies, they've made him Lord of the Ivories. Now at home, as well as abroad, they call him Mr. Jelly Lord. Now, you may be thinking that it might be a bit egotistical of me naming a song after myself. But really, now, anybody who was anybody in the city of New Orleans at that time, they had a song named after them. Usually for heroic reasons, people held high in the minds of their fellow citizens. Not all the time, though. Some people had songs named after them for quite a different reason. A perfect example is a guy I used to play pool with. I couldn't have been no more than 16, 17 years old at the time. Now, he had a song named after him because he was no doubt one of the most heartless men I have ever met. I didn't know it at the time, or else I never would have been playing pool with him. and I certainly would have never beat him at it. But he used to like to play pool with me because he knew that all the piano players at the different bordellos always had plenty cash money, and I was no exception. I'd walk up to the table, throw down my wad and say, "Okay, stand back with your little fives and tens and give my 50s here a chance to breathe." That's what I would say, showing off in front of him. Little did I know that the man I was talking to was Aaron Harris. The man already had 11 killings to his name. Aaron Harris is a bad, bad man. Aaron Harris is a bad, bad man. Now he's the baddest man ever was on this land. I tell you, between people like Aaron Harris and Hoodoo, and the racial prejudice that existed in New Orleans at that time, I found that I had to leave the city where I was born and raised and had truly come to love in my heart.
Vernell Bonnaries with Morten Gunnar Larsen at the piano, performing an excerpt of the review Jelly Roll, a tribute to Jelly Roll Morton. That excerpt was recorded on Fresh Air in 1992. Bonnaries is now on Broadway, starring in a revival of his review One Mo' Time. Here's the interview we recorded in 2000. Now, Vernell, your own productions have focused on early jazz and vaudeville, music from the earlier part of the 20th century. Why do you gravitate to that era? Is it music that you heard a lot when you were growing up, or something you developed a taste for later?
Well, I think that it's sort of the richest soup. That it's where everything sort of grew from, the fertile soil. And for me, I just find a great respect for the composers, for the performers at that time. I mean, they were really breaking ground, and it was an exciting moment. And people always refer to the Harlem Renaissance in the 20s and know about the literature of it. But there was a Renaissance period at that point because there was so much defiance and self-respect being built and pride. And I can feel all of that in the music. And the music was a popular music of that time. So they were really in the swing. It wasn't about nostalgia or whatever. And I think also coming from New Orleans, which is the hotbed of jazz and the birthplace, you just go to the real source.
What did you hear growing up in New Orleans?
Oh, I heard from a child. I heard the real bottom line traditional New Orleans music, the brass bands in the streets for funerals, and then we had the party bands for christenings and birthday parties, and people who are now thought of as the legendary founders of the music were people who were playing at that time. And they were older men at that point when I was a kid, but they were still there.
I've never been any place where there's been like a funeral brass band.
Uh-huh.
So I, to me, you know, when there's a funeral, it's a hearse and you know, a lot of cars going by with their lights on, and it's a really somber occasion.
Somber, yeah.
And when you see the funeral procession going by, you just kind of stop and get this chill for a few seconds, even when you don't know the people at all. Mm-hmm. What's it like for you growing up when a brass band would march by playing this great music because there was a funeral?
Well, you realize that it's a celebration of the release of the person from the miseries that life can present
if you're African American living in a segregated southern city. And so it's a party. They've graduated, and they're brought to all the places that they help to make a happy spot. Corner bars and different friends' houses, they're passed in front of it, and sort of a last goodbye and a congratulations that you graduated.
Now, one of the musicals you're well known for is One More Time, which was meant to be like a revival of a night at the Lyric Theater in 1926. Mm-hmm. And this is what you might have seen on stage there. Mm-hmm. So you do a lot of songs from the 20s, songs I think perhaps that are even earlier
they're all
from the 20s?
Pretty much the 20s.
Okay. And what are some of the period issues that you had to deal with in doing that show?
Well, I did interviews with people who were still around and had been to that very theater, to the Lyric Theater, and people who had experienced the TOBA circuit.
That's the Theater Owners Booking Association, which was alternately known as Tough on Black Asses.
Yes. And
it was like the vaudeville circuit for African Americans.
Yeah, definitely. Some of the issues that I dealt with was the idea of somebody coming in in the colored section of the train, which had to be second only to the cows and the mules, and then getting off the train and not being able to find a hotel because blacks weren't allowed in hotels. And so they had to get to a guest house or something across the tracks where they could stay. And then they come in with this beat-up suitcase, and out of it comes a gown or a suit. And then they hit center stage and become a star. And I think that that's incredible, because part of the whole pumping up of getting to that stage and being there is the treatment that you can receive at the hotel, in the restaurant, whatever. And they got nothing of it, and they were still able to get out there on center stage in a follow spot and hit it and give everything they had. And Bessie Smith could not get into a restaurant, eat afterwards, after a show. And yet that didn't stop them, because they knew they had something to offer. They had talent. They had spirit. They used the performances to say things that they couldn't say, because there were laws that no more than 6 blacks could gather in one place at one time without being considered a mob. And so they were, and in church they couldn't say certain things as a community. So they used this space to have social messages, to communicate respect to each other as a unit, to build each other's self-respect. And all those things I tried to add in through the structure of vaudeville jokes. How come we always got to stay at a place where hot and cold water means hot in the summer and cold in the winter? You know, they're complaining, but it's not the black defiance as much as it is through the structure of the black vaudeville joke, the way vaudevillians would treat material.
Well, I happen to have the original cast recording queued up.
Oh, okay.
Why don't we hear you singing Cakewalkin' Babies from the original cast recording of One More Time.
Okay.
Introduce the song for us.
Cakewalkin' Babies. It goes back, Cakewalkin' Babies goes back actually to an earlier period of the cakewalk being a number that slaves would use to make fun of the manners of the white owners. And then it became a vaudeville number. This one, by the time it hit the 20s, this is actually just a number.
Okay, so here's the number.
Okay.
Cakewalkin' Babies, sung by my guest, Vernell Bonnaries.
Cakewalkers may come, cakewalkers may go, but I want to tell y'all about this couple I know. They high-stepping gals and debonair. When it comes to business, not a soul can compare.
Here they come.
Well, here they come.
Look at them demonstrating, going some.
It's Cakewalkin' Babies from the original cast recording of One More Time, which was written, directed, and starred my guest, Vernell Bonnaries. And sorry for the couple of scratches you heard there. In my defense, I'll say this has not been reissued on CD. So, and it's from the recordings from the early 80s.
I must tell you, Terry, that One More Time, in its glory right now, you know, it's a hit musical and blah, blah. But we started it on $500 in my living room.
Performing in your living room?
We were rehearsing it in the living room, and the band was in the kitchen. And we opened for one night only in New Orleans on $500 to get together the set and the costumes. And to see that growth is just amazing. We wound up with 7 touring companies of it, and a Royal Command performance for the Queen in London, and the West End run. And just amazing what a dream can become.
We're listening to an interview with Vernell Bonnaries. He's now starring on Broadway in a revival of his review, One More Time. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Vernell Bonnaries, recorded in 2000. He's now on Broadway, starring in a revival of his review, One More Time, a tribute to Black vaudeville of the 1920s. I want to hear a little bit about your life, Vernell. Tell me a little bit about your family. You're from a Creole family?
Yeah, Creole family in New Orleans.
What does that mean exactly?
Creole in New Orleans means part Black, French, Spanish, and American Indian. Sort of a four-part thing. And we had our own culture, in a sense. There was a lot of literary people that came out of it. They had their own language, Creole French.
You speak it?
No, my father did, but they used it as an adult language.
Oh, kind of like Yiddish and Jewish houses.
Yeah.
So the kids don't hear.
The kids don't hear you, right. And that's unfortunate. But certainly, people know the food, which to me was sort of everyday cooking.
Tell us something more about your parents and their parents.
Well, my mother's name is Gloria Maria Diaz, and so obviously her side is Spanish-oriented. My father was, until last year, Lawrence Bonnaries from the French side of it. And they were the values are extremely based in Roman Catholic tradition, and it's extremely family oriented society, your uncles and your aunts and the idea that everybody sort of pitched together. There was no such thing as you could have and the person down the block didn't. It was a very open, giving sort of environment that I grew up in.
What was your attitude toward different ethnic groups, considering how many ethnic groups were in your family alone?
Well, that was the thing. There were so many ethnic groups that you couldn't have a prejudice. My grandmother, for example, my father's mother, was literally from Toulon, France. She spoke only French. She was white. And my father's father was from Haiti. And so he was part Black and he also spoke French. So they moved into this Creole area and they felt comfortable there. Creoles were not, they were light skinned for the most part, but they were not forgiven as far as racial prejudice was concerned. I remember as a child drinking from a colored water fountain, and we always understood that our Black blood was first. We were completely open to white, black, it just didn't matter because they may be your cousin.
Right.
And people chose, sometimes strictly for financial reasons. I remember my aunt, who's still alive in California, she and her sisters would go to work every morning. There was four of them. And three of them would go across the street to a colored cigar rolling factory. They rolled cigars. And she would go across the street to the white one because she made $2 more an hour. And she thought, well, I'm going to go for the money. But on the way home, they'd all get on the same streetcar and get back home. Huh. And it was a choice you made if you wanted to have that pressure in your life of trying to pass. You went on and did that if it made more financial sense for you. Or if you didn't, you didn't.
Do you have people in your family who passed?
Yeah. And some actually went to the point of sort of distancing themselves from the family. I remember at my grandmother's funeral, my father was furious because his two older brothers came to the funeral, and he'd always thought that they had passed for white and left and never really communicated with the family. But actually, they were products of her first marriage to a white guy. And they were white.
It's confusing, isn't it?
So he had to refigure once they told him the real story of it, because he just thought that they were brothers who had passed.
Vernell Bonnerice recorded in 2000. He's currently on Broadway, starring in a revival of his review, One More Time. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Substitute, sweet substitute. She tells me that she's mine, all mine. Does anything I tell her, love is blind. She's got such loving ways.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Crow Lake, a novel of sibling relationships by debut author Mary Lawson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The grueling long-distance sled dog race, the Iditarod, is underway in Alaska. Coming up, writer Gary Paulson remembers his experience in the race. Also, film critic John Powers reviews the movie We Were Soldiers, and TV critic David Bianculli previews 9/11, a documentary shot in and around the World Trade Center on the day of the attacks.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Several wars are currently being dramatized at the movies. The film We Were Soldiers is based on a 1992 bestseller about Ia Drang, the first major land battle the Americans fought in Vietnam. It was written by Lieutenant General Harold Moore, who led the battle, and journalist Joseph Galloway, who chronicled it. Mel Gibson stars as the then Lieutenant Colonel Hal Moore. Film critic John Powers thinks We Were Soldiers fits interestingly into the history of movies about the Vietnam War and coverage of the current war in Afghanistan.
Back in 1968, John Wayne made, paid for, and starred in The Green Berets, a pro-Vietnam War movie so cliché-riddled and deliriously hyperbolic that it instantly became a camp classic. The movie ended with the sun setting in the east. Hollywood learned its lesson, and over the next three decades, all the memorable Vietnam War movies, Apocalypse Now, The Deer Hunter, Platoon, were clearly critical of what came to be known as the Rock and Roll War. Well, there's no rock and roll in We Were Soldiers, a movie so devoutly square that you keep expecting John Wayne to turn up in a cameo. The year is 1965, and Mel Gibson is Lieutenant Colonel Hal Moore, a good Christian, a good family man, and a heck of a good leader of men. Moore's battalion is part of the 7th Cavalry, which, he uneasily points out, is General Custer's old outfit. And fittingly, after they reach Vietnam, they're choppered off to chase some enemy soldiers. Turns out it's a trap, and Moore's 400 men are caught in what came to be known as the Valley of Death. Suddenly, we're plunged into the kind of ultra-modern war movie pioneered by Saving Private Ryan and ratcheted up by Black Hawk Down. The picture turns into one long, protracted battle sequence, with Americans and Vietnamese being torched, blown up, and blasted by bullets. Gory red dots keep landing on the camera lens. But if the movie's taste for explicit violence is thoroughly up to the minute, its storytelling and sentiments are so corny that they would have had audiences rolling their eyes half a century ago. Here, for instance, Hal Moore talks to his little daughter.
Daddy?
Yeah?
What is a war?
War is, it's something that shouldn't happen, but it does. And it's when some people in another country or any country try to take the lives of other people. And then soldiers like your daddy have to, you know, it's my job to go over there and stop them.
Are they
going
to try to take your life away, Daddy?
Well, yes, Cecile, they're going to try. But I'm not going to let them.
As one who grew up during the Vietnam War, I must admit that We Were Soldiers moved me more than it deserved to. I found myself being filled with sympathy for both the naive teens who got sent off to Vietnam and for the honorable professional soldiers who got caught in that quagmire, to use a word that's again in fashion. In fact, Hal Moore is a very seductive figure, the honest, gutsy father we'd all love to have. Gibson works hard to make him come alive, but he's not altogether convincing. Over the years, Gibson's looks have thickened and coarsened. He now resembles a muscled-up soupy sales. But his Moore has none of the dark, obsessive undertones that he brought to, say, Mad Max. Here, he's 100% hero. Then again, so is everyone else. Although it was shot before September 11th, the movie feels as if it had been made to promote our current war effort. All the American soldiers are shown to be honorable and grave. There's no racial tension, no discord between officers and enlisted men, no drugs, no sex, not even much cursing. There's also no political consciousness. Although 37 years have passed since the events depicted in the film, writer-director Randall Wallace has no historical point of view on what he's showing. Was the war a good thing? Were the soldiers betrayed by the politicians? Was the small bit of land Moore's men fought for worth claiming? Moore knows his men are being set up to die, and still, as a good soldier, he follows orders and leads them into battle. How are we supposed to feel about that? Wallace doesn't duck these issues. He doesn't even notice them, all of which makes We Were Soldiers' celebration of heroism feel deliberately clueless. After all, we've seen Platoon and Apocalypse Now. We've heard a U.S. senator admit his involvement in the massacre of Vietnamese civilians and heard other U.S. senators defend his actions as being perfectly reasonable in the context. We've even seen TV footage of American politicians shaking hands with the leaders in Hanoi. And still, the movie portrays the Vietnam War as if nobody learned anything since 1965. Well, actually, we have learned one thing. Wallace gives the Vietnamese soldiers their dignity. Where the Green Berets dished up the same racist stereotypes used against the Japanese in World War II, and other Vietnam movies largely tended to treat the Vietnamese as hookers or cannon fodder, We Were Soldiers goes out of its way to depict them as human beings, just like our heroes. That still doesn't make this movie any good, but it's nice to know that the world occasionally does inch forward.
John Powers is executive editor and media columnist for the LA Weekly. Coming up, running the grueling long-distance sled dog race, the Iditarod. This is Fresh Air. The grueling, long-distance sled dog race, known as the Iditarod, is currently underway in Alaska. It spans more than 1,100 miles from Anchorage to Nome. Writer Gary Paulson wrote a book based on his experience in the race. That book, Winter Dance, was adapted into the film Snow Dogs, which opened earlier this year. Paulson writes books for young adults as well as books for adults. He's won several Newbery Awards. Much of his writing is based on his own life, which has been filled with adversity and adventure. He's worked as a teacher, soldier, actor, trapper, and migrant farm worker. He's been a drunk and at one time lived in incredible poverty. Right now, he's speaking at schools in Naperville, Illinois, where his books have been selected for their citywide reading program. In 1992, after the publication of his novel Clabber Dirt, Sweet Grass, I asked him to describe the Iditarod.
Yeah, you go from Anchorage to Nome, right across the middle, kind of, and you go across a few mountain ranges and up the Yukon River and then out to the Bering Sea, and then you run across part of the Bering Sea, too.
Now, my favorite part, if I have the rules right, is that if you're collapsing or near death, no one is supposed to come to your aid.
They won't help you. They'll step over you. They won't. If anybody helps you, you're disqualified, and they know that. So if you say, I scratch, or if you say, I need help, then you're out of the race, and then they'll help you, and they'll do anything. I mean, people will, you know. But another musher can help you without being disqualified. So other mushers, they help each other across. I mean, even the really competitive front-end people do. If somebody's in trouble, they'll stop and help. And I know people who are very dedicated to winning who have stopped and lost positions because they've stopped to help somebody build a fire because they went through the ice or, you know, they're wet or something, things mm-hmm. like that.
You can explain to me, a non-adventurer, what is so thrilling about the Iditarod?
Christ, I don't know. It's insane to do it. My wife says you got to kind of crank your IQ down to about 13.
Why?
But I think there's also a cliche that says no marriage survives three Iditarods, and it's maybe not accurate in my case, but it does put a strain on your life. What happens is you become a cave painting. You go back thousands and thousands of years. The dogs don't know that it's high tech. They don't understand technology. And so to run those dogs, to bond with them the right way, you have to become very primitive in your mind. I'm not talking about macho crap here now, but I'm talking about becoming purely human, truly human, without the modern trappings. And that is becomes a very desirable state. It still is. I miss it terribly.
What does it mean? What kind of state is this?
A kind of a primitive exaltation. You begin to realize what's very important in your life, and it isn't how you look, and it's not money, and it's not. You just understand the basics of what you're doing, of breathing, of living, of thinking, of reacting to the nature. I think part of it is we have lost the bond with the earth that we need. And farming. And the race are similar in that they reestablish that bond. It has to be there. When you run dogs, you cannot run them like a snow machine. You know, you have to understand that they are dogs, are very primitive, and you have to go back to that earlier bond. And farming is the same, I think.
What kind of relationship do you have to the dogs who pull your sled, I mean, how do you build a relationship with them differently than you'd build a relationship with a pet dog?
Well, you're just with them more. And what happens is they learn to read your shoulder motions and the way you think and the way your voice sounds. In fact, you growl after a while. You growl at them a lot. And not, I mean, you talk that way. You just talk, you know, and they understand what you mean. And they became closer than other people. I mean, lead dogs knew me better than my wife knows me. I mean, really, seriously, and I'm very close to my wife. I mean, it's just that the bond that happens is extremely close. You live because they make the right decisions, lead dogs, for instance. You can die if they make the wrong decision. If they take you on bad ice or if they don't want to do something that's safe, you can really get messed up.
I find it interesting that somebody as verbal as you, both as a speaker and as a writer, would spend all this time in a completely nonverbal situation.
I got over 20,000, maybe 22,000 miles on sleds.
Mm-hmm.
And most of that time, you're silent. You don't say anything because the dogs don't need you to talk much. And it's interesting because I lusted after it, the solitude. I just loved it. I wrote all the time. I ran dogs. When you train dogs, you run, say, 4 hours on and four off. And you just stop wherever you are and build a fire or sit down in a snowbank. And I had notebooks with me, and I would write. I tried a laptop for a while, but the batteries got cold, and they don't work when they're cold. I really did. I tried. About 10 below, you're done with a laptop. It won't work after that. And close to zero, even, is kind of rough. They don't like it much.
But what's the most awful or frightening part of running the Iditarod?
The hallucinations become really mean about the third night, and deciding what's real and what isn't real becomes kind of a nightmare in some cases. I mean, I had, at one time, I thought my whole team was on fire, and I was up throwing snow on them trying to put them out. They thought I was nuts. God, they couldn't understand what I was doing, you know. But I'd seen light flicking from the snow from their feet in the light from my headlamp, and I focused on it, and it got more and more, and then it started to look like little fires on their feet. And then, whew, the whole team went up. And I stopped, and I ran up, and I was screaming, you know, God, I said, you're on fire. And I was throwing snow on them, trying to put them out.
When did you figure out it was just a hallucination?
It just lasted, like, I don't know, a minute,
uh-huh.
Something like that.
What do the hallucinations come from? From
sleep deprivation. You simply don't sleep for the race. And you kind of catch dozes here and there, but you really don't sleep. And by the third night, everybody's wonky. I mean, it's really, from about midnight to about 6 in the morning, is just a fright. It's just incredible. That's the best time to run, because the dogs are. It's cooler and they like to run at night, and so you run during that time. But your brain is just fried, you know. I had this guy with a trench coat sitting on my sled for hour after hour, and he had a clipboard. He's wearing horn rimmed glasses, and he talked about government educational grants. He was the most boring human being in the world. And I had this bastard on my sled night after night. God, I was ready to kill him. And he would sulk. I would yell at him. I'd say, shut up, for God's sake. And he'd sulk for about a mile. It's just the most incredible thing.
Oh. So do you still do dog sleds?
No, I had a little heart problem a couple of years ago. I had to get rid of my dogs. I miss them, though.
Do you have any pet dogs?
Oh, yeah. We always got four or five dogs. What we do is we go to the pound. And we try to keep like a core level of about five dogs. So we go to the pound and we say, give us the next one you're going to kill. And we don't look at it. We don't find out what the breed is. We take it, whatever it is.
Uh-huh.
So I got a border collie, and I got a little terrier, and I got a half lab, and I got a chihuahua right now.
Would you ever keep a husky as a pet?
Sure. The problem with them is that they blow hair all the time.
Yeah, right.
Oh, God, they're just gouts of hair. In fact, we used to have to rake the kennel in the spring. We got up to where we had 90 dogs, 91 dogs.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, and you could rake, you would rake mountains of hair.
You strike me as a kind of obsessive guy, somebody who does something to real extremes when she decides to do it, whether it's drinking or sledding or writing.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I have no problem with that. I did with drinking. That was a terrible problem. The worst thing about drinking, and it's disgusting, is that it destroys clarity. Jesus, I can't. I've said this before some places, but I can't believe that I would do that, that I would try and damage that clarity,
mm-hmm.
the way you see things. It's just insane To use any kind of mind-altering chemical to me is just completely insane. Why would anybody want to do it? You know, to not see things as they really are, but some fuzzed-up piece of crap that has nothing to do with reality.
Yeah. You even did poverty to the extreme.
I still do.
But you have money now.
I don't, actually. I don't keep it. I give it to Ruth.
Your wife?
Yeah, I don't do anything with it. I have three pair of Levi's, and I replace a new pair every year. I get one pair a year when they wear. And I don't buy Mercedes and things. I don't do any of that.
Does it mean a lot to you to have written for young people because books changed your life so much when you were 15?
Yeah, it does. And I'm going to continue writing for young people.
Even as you write for adults?
Yeah. I'm just saying no more walls. The Clabber Dirt, Sweet Grass could be read by young people, too. It's not necessarily just an adult book. But it also has some complex things in it that I think younger people might have. Maybe would, many of them are smart enough to know it, but you know what I mean, that maybe it would be difficult for some. But I think it would work well for either one. And that's what I'm going to do from now on. I'm just going to write.
When you were doing the Iditarod, would you take a book with you?
Mm-hmm.
What would you take?
I worked every day, too. I really did. I had a notebook I wrote. And
what would you read?
I took, I know you want me to say Jack London. I don't think people like Jack London ever ran dogs. He didn't know what he was talking about mostly, but which is kind of sad because he was a good writer. But I took philosophy. I would take historical works,
mm-hmm.
Like study the first century, that kind of thing, and read. Sometimes when the dogs were resting and you couldn't sleep, and you get to where you don't sleep very well, you can't sleep. You just sit with your eyes open. I would read something, you know, just short pieces, a half a page or a page. And then I wrote, too. A lot of the writing was incoherent, though. I would look at it later and think, my God, you know, just scrawled across the paper. You know.
This is the same time that you were hallucinating.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. God, once I came into a village at night, and I could see people all over on snow machines. They were waving at me and yelling at me, and I was trying to turn my dogs up to in between these two cabins. There were lights in the windows, and I could see people inside eating at their table in the windows. And I blinked, and it was all gone. It was all hallucination, the whole thing. And it was really complex. I mean, God, I could, you know, snow machines were going by me. Guys offered me a beer. You know, it's just incredible.
Is this at all useful to you as a writer to hallucinate?
I don't think so, no. I don't think. It was an interesting study in maybe a kind of temporary madness. But in fact, that maybe that's what the Iditarod is. And what's really sick is I'd be doing it still. My heart. I would have gone again. I would have gone last year, the year before, and I'd be going this year. It just grips you. It just does. And nobody who runs that is ever the same again.
Well, Gary Paulson, I thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Writer Gary Paulson, recorded in 1992. The Iditarod is currently underway in Alaska. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews 9/11, the CBS special featuring documentary footage shot in and around the World Trade Center on the day of the attacks. This is Fresh Air. Sunday night at 9, CBS is presenting a two-hour account of the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center, captured by two filmmaking brothers who were witnesses to that day's events. Although many people are anxious to see images from inside the burning World Trade Center, some people are protesting this broadcast, accusing it of being inappropriate and insensitive. TV critic David Bianculli has a review of this special, which is called 9/11.
The usual way for a network to expose an upcoming program to TV critics is to send a tape. With the two-hour special called 9/11, it was handled very differently. The documentary was screened, once this past Monday night, at the Museum of Television and Radio. Only critics in New York, for the most part, were invited. I was one of them, and I went, to be honest, with a little bit of dread. This was 2 hours of footage from the Naudé brothers, Gideon and Jules, who happened to be filming a documentary on firefighters on the morning of September 11th. One image the NYU film school graduates captured that day was shared by all the networks in the immediate aftermath of the attacks. That ground-level shot of the first hijacked plane smashing into Tower 1 of the World Trade Center. That was 10 seconds. What would the rest of the 2 hours be like, and did I want to see it? Projected on a big screen, larger than life, larger than death, could I even handle it? The reactions to Sunday night's 2 hour special are bound to be as varied and personal as the events of that horrible day itself. I'm very respectful of those who don't want to revisit that disaster, and especially of those who lost loved ones that day in New York, in Washington, or aboard that plane over Pennsylvania. All I can do here is offer my own opinion as a barometer. The first thing you should know in deciding whether to watch the CBS program called 9/11 is that it's almost totally bloodless. It's not graphic, and it's not exploitive. Even though one of the brothers was among the first to arrive at Ground Zero with his team of firefighters, there are no shots of body parts or people jumping from the towers or other things I feared seeing. Jules Naudé, the younger of the brothers at age 28, says on the narrative soundtrack that the first thing he saw when he entered the lobby of Tower 1 with the rescue workers was two people who were on fire. He didn't film them, he said, because he didn't think it proper. For months, since June of last year, Jules and his brother Gideon, 31, had been filming a rookie firefighter in the Lower Manhattan company of Engine 7 Ladder 1. The idea for their documentary was to follow this young wannabe fireman, called a probie in firehouse lingo, for the 9 months it would take him to prove he had the right stuff. 9/11, the documentary, begins in June and ends long after September. Rather than abandon their original documentary concept, the Naudé brothers stayed true to it. As a result, we get to know the firefighters and even the filmmakers long before the planes arrive. On the morning of the attacks, firemen were dispatched to investigate a reported possible gas leak 14 blocks from the World Trade Center. The rookie fireman was assigned to stay and answer phones at the station house, so filmmaker Gideon stayed with him. Younger brother Jules, eager to get any practice with his camera, accompanied Battalion Chief Joseph Pfeiffer and his men to check out the gas main. While they were on the street that morning, they heard a roaring sound in the sky. The fireman looked up, and Jules swung his camera in that direction just in time to film the plane smashing into Tower 1. "You stay with me," the chief told the cameraman, and the fire truck headed straight to Tower 1. They went inside and set up rescue operations, and Jules never stopped filming. Gideon eventually hit the streets, too, and headed towards Ground Zero. Both of them captured spectacular footage, and each of them thought the other was dead. 9/11, the documentary, captures for posterity one inspirational act of quiet bravery after another. Robert De Niro hosts the program and frames it in what I think is the proper reverential context. Even CBS is being reverential. The documentary is interrupted only a few times, and by public service announcements by Nextel, not commercials. Dramatically, the most intense parts of 9/11 are not the sights, but the sounds. We don't see any of the falling bodies, but we hear their impact, and that's haunting enough. And when the debris cloud descends upon one of the brothers as he's filming, we hear that, too. I would urge, though, that you don't avoid 9/11 this Sunday on CBS because you're afraid of what you'll hear or see. What you'll see, if you decide to tune in, is humanity at its best. And a story that, in the midst of all that horrifying devastation, is a tale of honor, duty, resilience, and love.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a song written and performed by Abby Lincoln. She's performing a 3-day retrospective of her original songs presented by Jazz at Lincoln Center. This is I Sing a Song.
I sing a song of winter. I sing a song of spring. I sing a song of new love, songs that the seasons bring. I awaken with a feeling, sometimes weary at a glance, looking at my life's condition in the mirror by chance. Sometimes demons come to visit, I can hear them in the trees, or an elephant with thunder riding gently through the breeze. Sometimes thoughts of love come sailing, and I see you see your face, and I hear a voice that whispers, that calls to bring me grace, one that bids me sing another word, and helps me when I dare to gather in the darkness golden beads for my hair. So the morning brings the sunshine, sometimes they bring the rain, and when a feeling comes to me,
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Audi and the all-new A4. Information is available on the web at AudiUSA.com or 1-800-4-AUDI. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, John McWhorter, author of Losing the Race, Self-Sabotage in Black America, and a new book on the history of language. And on the six-month anniversary of 9/11, we talk with photographer Joel Meyerowitz. He's on an international State Department tour with an exhibition of his pictures of Ground Zero. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.